Welcome to HWTP Sports Talk with your host, David Weinstein. And now, David Weinstein.
Hello, Huddlin' fans. Thank you for listening to Huddlin' with the Pro Sports Talk with David Weinstein, featuring Pepper Johnson. My co-host, Pepper Johnson, is a 13-year NFL veteran player, a five-time Super Bowl champion as a player and coach, a member of the Ohio State Varsity O Hall of Fame, and a former defensive coach for the Bills, Jets, and Patriots. And something else we need to get for Pepper this week yet again, he's had some technical difficulties. So if you know somebody younger than 15 and who can help Pepper out and get him back online, give us a shout. We need your help. So joining us this evening is Rabbi Abraham Cooper. Rabbi Cooper is the Associate Dean, Director of Global Social Action Agenda of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, a leading Jewish human rights organization. Now, several weeks ago, against the backdrop of the Black Lives Matters movement, DeSean Jackson of the Philadelphia Eagles went on social media and reposted content quoting Adolf Hitler without understanding the meaning of the comments. In doing so, he stoked the fires of racism instead of encouraging a positive dialogue. Similarly, Nick Cannon made a poor decision by making anti-Semitic comments during his podcast, Cannon's Class. Cannon referred to fringe conspiracy theories about Jewish people, stating that black people are true Hebrews, and praised the controversial Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan. He followed up those remarks with some additional tweets. Now, both Jackson and Cannon issued apologies, but the real impact was that their comments showed their ignorance about prejudice towards Jews. Nick Cannon actually sat down with our guest, Rabbi Cooper, to discuss his mistake and to try to educate himself more about the issue. We will find out this evening whether or not that worked and also whether he was sincere in his effort to make amends. Rabbi Cooper, thank you for joining us tonight. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks, David. And I'm honored to be on your program. Let's see what rolls.
Now, you know, you and I are familiar, based on our cultural upbringing, of both the Holocaust and the culture and history of the Jewish people, but many of our listeners are perhaps not as familiar with that. It happened almost 80 years ago. It's hard to believe that that much time has passed. So if you could give a little brief synopsis and history of the Holocaust and what it was that the Jewish people went through.
Right. So I've been working for a place called the Simon Wiesenthal Center since 1977, since actually before we opened. Mr. Wiesenthal was a victim of the Nazis. He had married his childhood sweetheart in Eastern Europe, became an architect, actually designed a couple of buildings. But when World War II broke out and Nazi Germany invaded the rest of Europe, he was caught up, along with millions of other Jews, targets of a war against the people based on race. The Nazis had this thing of being the ultimate Aryans, and they were in the top of the pyramid. Everyone else had to serve them, but the worst people of all were Jews, and they didn't even deserve to live. The whole idea, the concept of genocide, the verbiage of what we now use today, that whole vocabulary had to be created because by the time Hitler was stopped in 1945, the end of World War II, two out of every three European Jews was dead, including millions who were gassed in death camps or died in concentration camps. Mr. Wiesenthal himself owes his survival to U.S. troops who burst into the Mauthausen concentration camp in early May 1945. He was too weak to stand. He only weighed about 90 pounds, but he and his wife lost 89 members of their family, basically wiped out. And unlike most other survivors, who thank God, were able to get to pre-state land of Israel, the U.S., Canada, Australia, Simon Wiesenthal never really left the Holocaust. He became the famous Nazi hunter. He forced the world to confront what took place. He warned that what happened to the Jews could happen again to others in terms of the scope, the industrial size of this mass murder. And he believed also in educating people and in bringing criminals to justice And that justice meant in a courtroom and not at the end of the barrel of a gun. I'm not sure I would have followed the same path, God forbid I went through it. But to understand the scope, two out of every three, they had 1.5 million Jewish kids, including Anne Frank, who were murdered by the Nazis. So Mr. Wiesenthal became a symbol. Back in 1977, Rabbi Marvin Heyer went to Vienna, Austria, where he was amongst all of the Nazis and neo-Nazis, and asked for his good name. And we've been doing our work ever since.
And that's a perfect juxtaposition to take us into the conversation I'd like to have with you this evening that incorporates what it was that DeShaun Jackson did and what Nick Cannon did, and shows exactly that, that education is so important for people to understand what they say and the consequences of what they say. And that, as you so eloquently stated, what happened to our ancestors all that time ago could just as easily happen again if we don't educate ourselves and prevent our society from turning into just the exact same thing. So, you know, what Jackson did and what Nick Cannon did, you know, we have an athlete and a celebrity that have access to and a lot of followers on social media, and understanding that they wanted to promote this message about social injustice and what happened in Minnesota and what's happening throughout the country and the Black Lives Matters movement, they did it in a way without being educated about what they were saying. And then as a result, their message gets both lost and misconstrued in what happens here. So what is it that these people, these athletes and these celebrities can do to make sure that they don't get off topic and off point with their message?
So one of the things that Rabbi Heyer told Nick Cannon at our second meeting, to remind everybody in the room, is that Jews and African Americans are natural allies because of our shared history, because we're both minorities. Obviously, not all Jews are people, quote unquote, of color. But let's just put the whole thing about white Jewish privilege to rest. 6 million Jews were not white enough for the Nazis. So we never conceived of ourselves as a race, meaning that how did we get from the days of Selma, Alabama, when you had a rabbi linking arms with Martin Luther King Jr. And our sainted, Congressman John Lewis, to where we are today? And we try to explain that there, you know, back then when I was a teenager, as a Jew, and I was brought up as a religious Jew in New York, I was mesmerized by M.L. King because his vocabulary was all from the Hebrew prophets. And he spoke while he was obviously a major leader in the fight for fundamental equalities in an unequal society. He also understood how to speak to the larger America and try to float the boat at the end of the day for everyone. The bottom line, as I see it, and I've said that also to Nick Cannon, is that you have people who want to present everything through the lens of race, black or white. You have other people who say, well, if you take that position, that means they're going to hate me automatically, and I don't want to have anything to do with them. Well, look, you have another vision, and that's the vision of what Martin Luther King said in the March of Washington. His vision was, someday here in America, we'll just evaluate people based on not the color of their skin, but the character of what they do. You know, it's very nice for a rabbi to go around preaching. Look, I'm not a preaching rabbi. I work at the Simon Wiesenthal Center. I support my local rabbi. But for sure, it's not my job to preach or to other groups or to start getting involved in issues that, like, who suffered more? Well, you know, blacks are the number one targets of race-based hate crimes in the U.S., and Jews are the number one target of religion-based hate. Neither of us want to hold those positions, and we have it. So the question is, what happened? And I think the answer has a lot to do with the messaging of Louis Farrakhan. And Farrakhan, as you know, for those of us who are not African American, what's his power? What's his main point that he's making to African Americans, which he's done since the 80s? It's about black empowerment. It's about empowering individuals. it's standing up, if you will, to the white man when it's necessary. I think actually trying to, you know, give a sense of supremacy, if you will, to being an African American, etc.
You're listening to HWTP Sports Talk with David Weinstein, recognized by our guests and listeners for our no-holds-barred good questions and informed conversation. Don't be shy. Post your questions and comments at hashtag AskHWTP.
For Jews, Farrakhan is the kind of, hate to say it, but, you know, he's kind of like a black KKK to Jews. When he calls Hitler a great man, when he says my religion is a gutter religion, what you discover is that for many African Americans, they don't hear those quotes. Mm-hmm. They hear the other very important message that not only he and other African Americans talk about. And when I speak to young African Americans, they say, look, we don't have a lot of real leaders. This guy's been around for decades. He's been consistent. That's absolutely the case. He has been consistent and he's a great orator. Our problem is, unfortunately and tragically, he hates us.
Well, and that was the thing I was going to say. Most of his speech and most of the way he drives his followers is quite similar to that of Hitler, in that it's based in hate. It's based in getting his message across as the hatred of this other group of people, unlike Martin Luther King, who was fostering more of a message of love and understanding and education. And it's a shame that when people try to get across the message, they don't see that this message is coming through as a hate message. And I think that's part of the problem that Nick Cannon had, and that's part of the problem that DeSean Jackson had, was they saw some sort of end-of-the-road message but didn't see the method that it was getting put across. And that's what put them in the crosshairs of a big problem for both of them.
Right. It is a tragedy. And unfortunately, all the wrong people are left smiling. What do I mean by that? Well, when we had this exchange and then later on, I went on his, you know, we met in his office and then he came to the recent to the Museum of Tolerance, the blowback, the inevitable blowback from bigots of all colors, mm-hmm. was not only huge for him, but also so big we had to shut off our responses on our Instagram account because the hate that was flowing back was so profound. I'm a rabbi, so I believe that one of the great contributions of Judaism to civilization is the very idea that people can change. We don't believe in saints. We don't have any. We like to see, hopefully, people acting in a saintly way like a Martin Luther King Jr. or Rabbi Heschel. We have our spiritual heroes, but we don't believe in saints. That means that if someone makes a mistake, recognizes it, and tries to make amends and go on, you have obligation to do so. In fact, Nick Cannon, who I found out, of course, since is a voracious reader, he actually reminded me of what Maimonides says about repentance. And it's absolutely Jewish law. If someone hurts you and they request three times for you to forgive them, assuming there's no monetary, you know, loss or whatever. So by the end of the third time, you have to forgive them or the sin's on you. So I found out that Nick Cannon, who I didn't know very much about before, is pursuing a PhD in theology, I think at Howard University, is a voracious reader, and even gave me a very excellent quote from the Ethics of the Fathers in Hebrew.
Wow.
So I think, you know, if we're looking directly at where we're at in the bigger, in writ large, where we're at today, and I've said this, I said it to Nick, and I really believe America's at a turning point and a tipping point, which is you have to choose between two visions moving forward. Is it the vision of seeing everything through the lens of race? Mm-hmm. Or is it the vision seeing it through the lens of Martin Luther King Jr.? You know, everybody knows they get the third Monday, I think, in January off. But I think generations of young people of all religions and races and ethnic groups in the U.S. don't know very much about him. And here's the key point you mentioned about change before. There was a time that people hoped that perhaps Farrakhan was opening a new chapter. It's when he announced that he was doing the Black Million Man March.
Mm-hmm.
And the theme of that march, we were told, was about repentance. And yet, when he did a little digging, John Lewis, at the time, in real time, basically said he rejected the invitation for one reason, the anti-Semitism of Louis Farrakhan. So that would explain in part, I mean, John Lewis was actually honored twice by the Simon Wiesenthal Center over the decades. He came to speak in the Museum of Tolerance. We showed his documentary. And every person of the 7 million people who've come through so far, they see a 9-minute clip called Ain't You Gotta Write. And John Lewis, a young one, is right in the middle of it as an activist, and later on saying, while he's sitting in his office in the Congress, I hated racism. I think that's the only thing that John Lewis really actually hated.
Right.
Hated racism and hated evil, but always left the door open, in terms of reconciliation with people. So in that sense, he's also my Rebbe, my teacher.
You're listening to HWTP Sports Talk with David Weinstein, recognized by our guests and listeners for our no-holds-barred good questions and informed conversation. Don't be shy. Post your questions and comments at hashtag AskHWTP.
I want to follow up on two things with you that you mentioned. The first is education and history, and you made reference to sitting down with some young African-American kids who really didn't have a grasp of history and what had taken place and what went on. I think that's something that repeats itself as we go through different critical stages in our culture and in our society, especially today. I'm not that old. You're not that old. A lot of our listeners are not that old. But people who are younger than we are tend to have a very short attention span in general. Are very quick to find a quick answer and to move forward with that answer, and they ignore history. And as the rest of us know, if you don't learn from and pay attention to history, it will repeat itself. So aside from requiring core classwork in the history of the Jewish people, in the history of immigrants to the United States, in the history of African Americans and how they got here and what they've had to go through as the years have progressed, what can we get the younger people to do so that they understand they need to learn from history or it's going to repeat itself?
Well, it's a big shock when young people, as they go out into the real world to try to get a job, you know, find out that not all answers are a Google click away from Wikipedia. You can get factoids, but you can't get perspective. You don't understand what memory is. Those relationships online might be powerful, but they're not, at the end of the day, real. I think the most important part, and obviously courses and films and documentaries and maybe even little projects that we hopefully will be doing, let's say, with the Nick Cannon, that may be no more than a couple of minutes to introduce true, other heroes of to understand the human dimension is critically important. But it is a two-way street, meaning our communities need to reconnect, and there's plenty to reconnect about. There's homeless, there's feeding the hungry, there are startups, you can go on and on. And I think, a natural basis. If the relationship was that close for that long in the last century, we should be able to reconnect and find some creative ways, even for the younger people, understand the great opportunities that are out there, and for the elders to understand that we can't afford to wait after this pandemic is over.
Mm-hmm.
Don't wait for the next crisis. You know, I know quite a few African-American pastors in the Chicago area. I've met some in the New York area. Except you're talking about heroic people who've been on the front lines before there was a pandemic, before the Black Lives Matter protests, before the murder of George Floyd, before the riots. And they're going to be there the day after. So I mean, the wonderful thing about 21st century America is there's no shortage of great African-American role models and people who can make things happen. Well, American Jews have that opportunity, and I would say obligation, to try to reconstruct some of those alliances and to work together. That's the best antiseptic to stereotypes and to hatred. If you know someone face-to-face, then the chances are maybe you're going to correct someone who hasn't seen a Jew or only reads about it on social media and knows how to push a button to get people to say, well, that was a horrible thing that you said, or worse, you know, the violence that is taking place before the pandemic on the streets of New York, where obviously religious Jews, you know, have been targeted, you know, for violence. So education is a baseline. That's why Mr. Wiesenthal gave us his name. He knew that we were going to help him track down Nazi war criminals. But what he really wanted was a broader commitment to educate people. It's one of the reasons why Rabbi Heyer thought of and created the Museum of Tolerance. And by the way, what's really interesting, you know, we have a Tools for Tolerance program where we've already trained 130,000 law enforcement, besides programs that we have for teens and people in the business arena. I remember one of the main things that inspired us to do this was when a state senator from California came to my office. It's probably 25 years ago. And, you know, he's excited about the museum, et cetera. And then he said, by the way, I hope one of the issues you're going to deal with if you're going to try to train the police is, why do I get pulled over 3 times in the last 4 weeks when I drive through Beverly Hills for the crime of driving while Black?
And that's something that we often hear all the time. And it isn't something that should be a crime. You shouldn't get pulled over because your skin color doesn't match the neighborhood that you're in. But something, again, something you said, and this is often what happens when you listen to a rabbi speak, triggered a thought in my mind. One of the strongest lasting images I have growing up and learning about the Holocaust is hearing from survivors who were there, who had that tattoo on their arm and were able to say, this really happened. This is what happened to me. This is what happened to my family that left a long lasting impression on me and on the people I grew up with. And I think that that's something, although they didn't survive necessarily a Holocaust, but some of the professional athletes that they have an obligation to do. We've often talked about what kind of an obligation does an athlete have now that he or she has a social media platform and something they can do. Well, as you pointed out, what the late Senator Lewis did and what others have done is they need to go back out into the neighborhoods where they grew up. And they need to remind the people who live in that neighborhood, whether it's the kids who live there or the people who are still there, this is what I came from. This is what I've made of myself. And this is what you need to remember that you need to do so that you educate yourself and realize that there's no place for intolerance and that you need to educate yourself about your fellow man and to encourage law enforcement to come into those neighborhoods with them, with their star and celebrity power, and say, look, I'm not afraid to be with this police officer. You shouldn't be either. And to use some of that interaction to show these police officers that not every young person of color or whose skin is different than the color of yours is a threat to you and that they can interact with them. We've seen countless pictures of police officers playing basketball, playing baseball, playing kickball in the street with the people in their community. We all have to get more comfortable with each other and not fear each other and not have that hatred that's there. And I think that that's something that athletes have an obligation to do and that celebrities have an obligation to do. And if it means going to get your assistance at the center to learn how to train not only law enforcement, but other people to get that message across, then that's what they need to do. Because without education and without learning about history, we're just going to continue down this path. And the path that it's taken us is not a pretty place. This is not putting coronavirus aside. 2020 has been a horrible year. And a lot of it is because of our intolerance for each other.
I do think that the pandemic, first of all, speaking institutionally, we've been around since the LA riots, The Museum of Tolerance has always been a space where we could bring together disparate voices from the community so they can talk, maybe with anger, but they can less talk with each other. So I actually think that there are two elements that have heightened everything here. Number one is the pandemic, because we can't have a normal conversation face to face. And number two, as a result of it, the power of social media, which was already enormous, has just gone through the roof, because we're all on there. We're all susceptible to rumors and bad jokes and racism and all the rest. And, you know, for full disclosure, I was born in Brooklyn. I remember meeting Sandy Koufax, because his aunt and uncle lived in the apartment next to ours. I remember in 1999, when we honored Jackie Robinson on the 50th anniversary. Yeah, 50th anniversary of Breaking the Color Barrier. We converted part of our museum into Ebbets Field. And Duke Snider came to open it. I was able to tell Duke Snider, whose knees were already shot, he could barely walk, I remember as a six-year-old the catch you made in Ebbets Field in, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yeah, you know, you have Bibi Netanyahu and the Dalai Lama. Forget that. When you have sports,
yes,
your sports hero walking through the door, whether you like it or not, they walk on water. Sort of, you know, kind of embarrassed. I mean, I'm still a Mets fan. I'm still, I still follow the Giants and the Jets. I mean, it's ludicrous. But and I remember as a 9 and 10 year old, when I got my first transistor radio, I was a fanatic baseball fan. So I found out like at 10 p.m., I could catch the last couple of innings from Cincinnati because they had a 50,000 watt clear signal.
Right.
So you don't have to convince me about the power of the potential of sports heroes. You know, when I go to Japan many, many times, and I've never been to Kabuki Theater, but I've been to a half a dozen baseball games, you know, in Tokyo. So the power of sports worldwide is there. And maybe for, you know, a person who has golden hands and can withstand, you know, 400 pounds coming at him to knock the ball loose. They didn't ask necessarily for that part of the package, but it absolutely is. One way or the other, you are the role model. And I think part of the issue also is, for that generation that you talked about, there's no online librarian. There's no filter in social media. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a half-hour conversation with Nick Cannon where I came to the conclusion he could be a serious person. So I said, okay, I'm coming to see you. I want to see you face to face. I didn't know he was going to record our first conversation for 2 hours. You know, if you and I had met a couple of years ago, we would have, you know, go for a drink or maybe a dinner, get to know each other. The younger generations cut right through that, and everything is sort of recorded and memorialized in real time. That's like, you know, walking on a high wire, if you know what I mean. So,
and it puts a lot of pressure on you to, you know, you only make one first impression. And so if that first impression is then immediately going to be recorded and memorialized forever, you're never going to get a second chance to make that first impression. And that's why these athletes are so, in my opinion, responsible for accepting the mantle that goes with it and carrying that message forward as well.
You're listening to HWTP Sports Talk with David Weinstein, recognized by our guests and listeners for our no-holds-barred good questions and informed conversation. Don't be shy. Post your questions and comments at hashtag AskHWTP.
There may be 2 points about Nick Cannon's third contact with me, which was when he actually came to see us in West Los Angeles at the closed museum and the closed Wiesenthal Center. We met with our Rabbi Hirin, our top staff. So there are two things that come to mind from that visit. Number one is he held in his hands an original document prepared by and signed by Adolf Hitler in September 1919. When he was still in the German army and he was part of an intelligence unit. And the story goes that they said, well, they're writing reports about who can make trouble for post-World War I Germany. What about the Jews? Oh, Hitler's always talking about the Jews. Let him write it. Well, what he wrote in September 1919 and signed was the precursor to what he would put into action 20 years later. And so that was, you know, a message to the Nick Cannons of the world and, mm-hmm. and to the sport. The power of words is so enormous. And thank God we live in a society where you have free speech. But words do have consequence. And the second thing was, I had a chance to actually quietly take him to a small synagogue and study hall. And I wanted him to see what a Torah scroll, you know, the five books of Moses, the Old Testament, what it looked like. We took it out from the Holy Ark. We opened it up. It's on parchment. It's written in special ink. You read from right to left. And Nick never seen anything like that before in his life. He's gone for a PhD in theology. Why did I want him to see that in the inside of a Talmud and the inside of a Hebrew prayer book? Is because the Farrakhans of the world always come back to that term, synagogues of Satan.
Mm-hmm.
We want the way to debunk these things is if you could do it for a couple of million people. And we have many pastors and many rabbis all over the United States, not during crisis, but during normal times, take time to demystify each other, to get to know each other. I feel badly that the Philadelphia fellow apparently is a native Angeleno and never made it to the Museum of Tolerance when he was in school. You know, we have literally millions of students who've come through. I'm sorry he never had that exposure. I can tell you one thing. Had he, then that statement never would have been made. And the other piece of it, which is a tough piece, which is, you can't land up successfully fighting hatred. I don't care who the target is, if there's no consequence at all. And that brings us to the issue like, well, what do you think about Nick Cannon? Is he serious? You know, I'm not naive. He was, you know, his whole world was on the verge of crashing down. When I met Nick Cannon face to face, a voracious reader, he was reading Barry Weiss's book about the New York Times. She had just told the New York Times to go fly a kite. He just finished her book. It was on his desk. So what we've done since our first meeting, and right now he's in New York, I guess, doing his show. But when he gets back, he'll have a book that Rabbi Heyer suggested from Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik called Lonely Man of Faith, one of the greatest minds of the 20th century. Believe me, he won't zip through that book, but he'll read it. And another, a wonderful book about leadership from Lord Jonathan Sacks, who's the former chief rabbi of the UK. And I, you know, we've been in touch a little bit by email. I'll send them a quick quote, you know, from a rabbi, something that I think I know would be of interest to him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the most central issue for him and all of those who've crossed the line is an unbelievable story told about a saintly rabbi, David, who would never make it in the 20th century. His name was the Chafetz Chaim. He lived in the late 19th and early 20th century. What was his thing? He never repeated a rumor.
Well,
and he didn't want anyone, even if it was true, don't repeat a falsehood, don't repeat a rumor. Never would have had a lot of likes on social media. So here's his story, though, that brings it home. I probably told this 25 times in very high-powered meetings in Japan. The Japanese lead the league in hating to apologize for anything, including World War II. And when we would occasionally catch them doing things that they shouldn't in the corporate world, part of it would have to be an apology. And they would go through all of it and they would say, okay, I mean, are we fair and square now? Is everything okay? So I would tell them the following story. So the Chafetz Chaim had one of his followers come to him one morning in his study. And this was in, you know, Poland, people were dirt poor. And he said, Rebbe, master, teacher, you know, for years, every Sabbath, I come to the synagogue, I hear your sermon, I know what you tell is absolutely correct. But this morning I heard a rumor about my next door neighbor that I knew had to be true. And I repeated it. And just as you warned me, an hour later I found out it was false. What can I do to repent? So he said, you have a chicken? meaning back in those days, not Purdue chicken, a live one.
Right.
You have a live chicken. Yeah, I've got it. Go home, pluck the feathers from your chicken. Use the feathers to make a path from your door to the person you hurt. I don't want to know who it is. And from his door back here. So 90 minutes later, this fellow comes in out of breath. Rebbe, I did it. I plucked the feathers. I made the line to him and I'm here. Am I forgiven? And he said, yes, my son, absolutely. There's just one small task that remains. Collect the feathers. So what I told Nick was, more than most people, Nick Cannon, and I'm sure it's true of all the sports heroes and the influencers, they actually have powerful platforms to collect feathers, because that same audience that they reached with turns out to be a hurtful untruth.
Mm-hmm.
If they have the guts and the moral clarity to do the right thing, they actually can come about as close to anyone to collecting those feathers.
Do you believe that Nick was sincere and that he's going to go back and he's going to collect those feathers?
I think he's begun the process. And here's the other point. And I warned him about the blowback, even in our phone conversation. I said, you know, yes, it'll be very important for you to apologize. Understand what just happened to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar the day before with his op-ed calling out black anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
And Kareem can take care of himself. You know, it's not a problem. He's a complete human being that way. But he was called Judas. How much money did the Zionists pay you to write it? Oh, you're in the back pocket of the Jews, et cetera, et cetera. It did an impact. But I said, I'm warning you. I'm just telling you that you're going to have a blowback, and that's going to, be a challenge. I didn't say it to him, but it's kind of a gut check, because we don't live in a society that values very much apologies. We live in a society that says, oh, I said that 2 days ago, let's move on. And now I have another 23,000 likes, so I'll keep that in mind if I need to move it. The whole idea of taking a deep breath, reflecting on what you did, and if you made a mistake, actually trying to make amends. I never thought it would be a revolutionary idea, but in 2020, in the midst of this pandemic and everything else going on, you know, maybe it is. So I think he is in the right path. Some of his creative people and director of our Mariah Films Division, Academy Award winner, Rick Trank, they've had some preliminary discussions. I'd love to see the creative juices combined to create some, if you will, quote-unquote product. I don't care if it's 90 seconds long or 5 minutes long, to start educating young people of all backgrounds about some real heroes. Let's say we're talking about what the NBA is going to do. If they would ask me, what I would do is that every month for, let's say, the next 20 months or whatever happens with the seasons, you have the icon. Start with Martin Luther King Jr.
Mm-hmm.
The second month, you know, maybe it'll be the late congressman. There are, thank God, so many amazing African-American real heroes that when a father comes in with his kids, if he can still afford a ticket, into an arena, the kid's going to say, who's that on the floor? People watching at home. So instead of giving me, a quote or a shout out to a particular group, we're so past that. Why don't we just reconnect with the real heroes? And when you're finished with the African-Americans, you can go to Latinos and you can go to Asian-Americans. There might be a couple of American Jews. That's what should be driving today, the NFL, the NBA, because when they get behind a message and messaging, but it's unparalleled. It serves their business model, but it also serves to help bring Americans together in a positive way.
And they have the platform for it. They have the outreach for it. They have the ability to do it. And they need to use those tools. And with the younger generation, it's going to need to be in 90-second snippets or 5 minutes at the most, and they're going to have to do it potentially virtually, and they're going to have to draw them in on their small screens to let them see what's going on. And for as long as this pandemic lasts, that's how we're going to get our messages across, and that's how we're going to see everybody.
And maybe it'll be a free T-shirt or a backpack or whatever it is that they do for the messaging. But the idea is, now I'm not talking about only the players. I'm talking about the unions. Right. I'm talking about the NBA owners and the NFL owners themselves. The potential, to do good. Back in 1999, we did a float honoring Jackie Robinson at the Rose Parade. Do you know why the Wiesenthal Center had to do the float? Because they said no to the blacks.
Wow.
Now, they said no to the blacks from Pasadena, California, the hometown of the Robinson family. Mm-hmm. He had an older brother who won medals. They should have, when they were alive, should have been heroes leading those parades. And it took, you'll excuse me, my Lower East Side bred Rabbi Marvin Heyer to shame the committee
into doing
allowing us to bring a great American hero to the table.
And I can sympathize with your love of the Mets and the Jets and some other teams. I am a dyed in the wool Buffalo Bills fan, so I know my fair share of disappointment.
I'm old enough to remember Cookie Gilchrist.
Oh, well, then you are a little bit older than me. I know of him, but I don't remember him personally.
I am a bit older.
Do you have any predictions for your Mets if they can complete this season?
I don't know. I was actually studying in yeshiva in 1969 during that magical season, and I can only occasionally get U.S. Armed Forces radio. And the signal, would come in and out. And so Tommy Agee would go back. He didn't know if he caught it. I probably remember more about that season, having not been in New York that year. The prediction is the following. Whether it's in the U.S., in Korea, in Japan, sports is the vernacular. You know, there's the most decorated Japanese diplomat is a man named Matsura. He became the head of UNESCO, the top U.N. agency. This is 25 years ago. So I go to Paris. I walk into the man's office. I'm saying to myself, what do I have in common with a man who's a native Japanese? I'm from Brooklyn. Okay, I'm with the Wiesenthal Center. Then I saw that he had a baseball on his desk. Turns out he was a big Nomo fanatic from the LA Dodgers. So when he came, and we spent, of course, 45 minutes talking baseball and 10 minutes talking about the world's problems. But when he came to the Museum of Tolerance to speak on the 10th anniversary of our institution, and he had like 100 diplomats and the media was there, like, so what do you give a man who has everything and represents the best of what the UN is about, the United Nations? Of course, we gave him a complete Nomo uniform, cap, uniform. The whole nine yards. And that, of course, solidified a relationship that itself went on for 20 years and had great, positive impact. So you never know. What I asked Duke Snyder about Jackie Robinson, and people probably don't know that they both came up as rookies.
Right.
Snyder was a couple of years younger. And he said, you don't understand. Jackie Robinson, and they're both from L.A., Jackie Robinson was the greatest sports personality and athlete in the history of Southern California. I remember, he said, when I was a freshman in the south part of L.A., and he was a senior in South Pasadena High, there were a number of high schools that came together, to have multiple sports. It was cheaper that way. I remember Jackie Robinson caught the third out in the fifth inning. He was playing center field. He didn't come into the dugout. He hopped over the fence, changed from his baseball cleats to running shoes, anchored. He was the fourth guy anchoring
the relay team.
Four-time 100 thing. Won the race, came back, jumped over the fence, put on his cleats, and went on with it. So he said, you don't even understand how great this man was. These are just precious, precious moments. If you get the impression how much I love sports, I remember that a friend, my first time in box seats, my birthday, June 1964, we went to a Phillies-Mets doubleheader. And I suffered through Jim Budding's perfect game.
Oh.
So if you're a kid who's 14, who cares if you're seeing history? Why can't they hit the damn
right.
ball?
Right. Well, sports is the one thing that unites us and the one thing that we've really been hurting for and not having. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to talk about a very serious topic with us on a place where we often talk about sports, but we saw the two things intersect with each other. So we can't thank you enough and really appreciate you joining us.
Just to emphasize again that sports can be the solution if there really is a level playing field. And I think that the folks who own these leagues and run these leagues need to remember that. Don't tinker with what's right. Stick with that and then empower and send out the messaging that only the NFL, the NBA, and Major League Baseball, and maybe the soccer folks as well, you know, here in the States can do. They have a great opportunity, and I would say, as a rabbi, to try some Jewish guilt. They have great responsibility right now to do it right.
With great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah. So, you know, we actually had a traveling exhibit on Jackie Robinson that we took based on what we did in the museum to a lot of parks around the country. We rediscovered some of the pockets where, you know, shall we say, old habits die hard.
Yeah.
We eventually donated it to the Black Baseball Hall of Fame.
And we had the president of the Black Hall of Fame on a couple of weeks ago. And when
they're in Kansas City, I think.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, they
are.
I
was there at Shea. We had it up at Shea down the left field line.
Wow.
The night that President Clinton and Mrs. Robinson threw out the first ball.
Thank you again.
My pleasure. You're welcome to edit anything out. It'll probably be a special mitzvah if you can cut this in half.
But Jackie David, works miracles.
Take care.
Take care.
Nice meeting you, Jackie.
Thank you for listening to Huddling with the Pro Sports Talk with David Weinstein, featuring five-time Super Bowl champ Pepper Johnson. We're the podcast that tackles all the controversial hot-button issues from the world of sports, recognized by our guests and listeners for our hashtag no holds barred, good questions, and informed conversation. By day, I practice criminal defense law with Hinshaw and Culbertson in Miami, Florida. But once a week, you can find me here on HWTP Radio. The show is produced and edited by Jacqueline Park and is a Sweet G Communications production. Remember, you can find a new episode of Huddling with the Pro Sports Talk every Friday at hwtpradio.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at HWTP Sports Talk. Missed a show? Visit our website at hwtpradio.com and download our podcast on your smart device. Special thanks to Rabbi Cooper for joining us this week to have a somewhat serious conversation. So goodbye for now. We'll see you next week.